Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we are stripping the paint off one of the most terrifying concepts in all of economics. We're looking at the mechanics of the bank run, you know, the image lines around the block, people banging on locked doors, just the total collapse of faith.
It is the ultimate financial nightmare, yeah.
But the real question we're asking today is that panic the cause of the bank's death, or is it just the funeral?
Right.
We're digging into a paper that really challenges the way we think about this. It's titled Bank Failures, The Roles of Solvency and Liquidity.
And the authors are Sergio Correa, Stefan Locke, and Emil Verner.
And this is a heavy hitter. They aren't just, you know, theorizing here.
No, not at all. They've built this massive historical data set to test the classic Diamond Dibvig model.
Which is the one that says a healthy bank can be killed by sheer panic.
That's the one.
Okay, before we get into all that data, let's just anchor ourselves in their exact argument. I'm going to read the abstract of the paper. It's a bit dense, but I really want you to listen for two words. Fundamentals and insolvent. Okay, here it is.
Let's do it.
Bank failures can stem from runs on otherwise solvent banks or from losses that render banks insolvent, regardless of withdrawals. Disentangling the relative importance of liquidity and solvency in explaining bank failures is central to understanding financial crises and designing effective financial stability policies. This paper reviews evidence on the causes of bank failures. Bank failures, both with and without runs, are almost always related to poor fundamentals. Low recovery rates and failure suggest that most failed banks that experienced runs were likely fundamentally insolvent. Examiners' postmortem assessments also emphasize the primacy of poor asset quality and solvency problems. Before deposit insurance, runs commonly triggered the failure of insolvent banks. However, runs rarely caused the failure of strong banks, as such runs were typically resolved through other mechanisms, including interbank cooperation, equity injections, public signals of strength, or suspension of convertibility. We discussed the policy implications of these findings and outlined directions for future research.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that is a direct shot across the bow of a lot of standard economic history.
It really is. So let's unpack this. The standard story, the one we see in the movies, like It's a Wonderful Life, that's the liquidity story.
Right. George Bailey's bank is fine. He's a good guy, made good loans.
But because everyone panics at once, the bank just runs out of cash on hand. It's a tragedy of coordination.
Exactly. In that narrative, the bank is solvent. Its assets are worth more than its debts, but it's illiquid.
It has the value. It's just locked up in long-term loans.
And if the mob forces a fire sale, the bank dies. It's that self-fulfilling prophecy.
But these authors, they're arguing for the solvency story.
Which is, well, it's a much darker take, isn't it?
Yeah. It says the bank isn't fine at all. It's made terrible loans, it's lost the money, and it's basically a zombie.
So the mob at the door isn't a tragic mistake.
No, it's a rational response to a bank that's already dead and just doesn't know it yet.
And to figure out which story is true, they set up this theoretical framework. We should probably talk about the model for a second.
Right, the timeline they use. It's broken down into time one and time two.
Simple enough. At time zero, the bank takes your deposits, invests them. Some is kept as cash, which is liquid, and the rest goes into loans, which are illiquid.
Okay.
Then at time one, some people want their money back. At time two, the loans finally mature and pay off.
And the whole problem is that if everyone shows up at time one,
the bank can't pay.
Right.
Right. Now, here's the key variable they introduce, theta. You could think of theta as the fundamental quality of the bank's loans.
So high theta means smart investments. Low theta means they bet on some bad horses.
Precisely. And the model identifies two critical thresholds for theta. The first one is the insolvency threshold.
Okay.
If theta falls below this line, the bank is fundamentally broke. The loans are so bad they will never, ever cover the deposits, even if everyone waits patiently until time two.
The bank is just toast, period.
Yes. But then there's a second threshold, the liquidity threshold. This is the gray zone.
Ah, okay.
In this zone, the bank is actually solvent if it can just make it to time two. But if a run happens at time one, the fire sale losses will bankrupt it.
That's the danger zone. That's where the It's a Wonderful Life scenario happens.
Theoretically, yes. But the whole point of this paper is to look at the data and ask, how many banks actually fail in that gray zone? Does panic really kill healthy banks?
Or does it just kill the ones that were already below that first insolvency threshold?
Exactly. And to answer that, they had to go way, way back.
Yeah, you can't just look at the last 10 years.
No, because we have the FDIC now. If your bank fails, the government just cuts you a check. Nobody stands in line in the rain anymore.
So they needed a pure laboratory.
Right. So they built this data set from 1863 all the way to 2024.
That is huge. 160 years.
It covers 5,120 bank failures. And the most important part is what they call the national banking era, from 1863 to 1941. This was before federal deposit insurance.
Wild West.
Total Wild West. If you didn't get your money out fast enough, you lost it. Perfect for seeing how fundamentals and panic really interact.
So they have the model, they have the data. Let's get to the findings. And I think we have to start with the biggest myth of them all, the Great Depression.
Oh, yeah. The dominant story, the one from Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, was that the Depression was made so much worse by these waves of panic that just destroyed perfectly good solvent banks.
A contagion of fear, I think they called it.
Yes. But finding number one in this paper, just, it blows that out of the water. They found that bank failures are almost always predictable.
Predictable how? Like, you can see it on the balance sheet.
Yes, exactly. They found that for up to 5 years.
5 years.
5 years before a failure, you can see the rot setting in. You see declining net income, low capital buffers, rising asset losses. It is rarely a lightning bolt from a clear blue sky.
And they mention asset booms as a major predictor, too.
That's a huge red flag. Mm-hmm. If a bank starts growing its loan book way, way faster than its competitors, it usually means one thing.
They're lowering their standards.
They're buying risk. And the data shows those growth spurts are a powerful predictor of a future collapse.
Okay, so bad banks fail. That makes sense. But here's the part that I found kind of counterintuitive. Surely the banks that got run on, the ones with the mobs, surely they looked healthier than the ones that just quietly failed.
That is the natural intuition, right? You'd think the run is some kind of tragic accident that happens to a decent bank. But this is their finding number two.
Yeah.
Failures with runs and failures without runs look almost identical on the fundamentals.
Wait, really? So the bank that gets crushed by a mob is just as sick as the bank that quietly gets shut down?
Statistically, yeah.
Yeah.
The data suggests runs don't strike at random. They don't attack healthy banks. They attack banks that are already weak.
So the run isn't the cause of death.
It's the symptom of the disease.
So why does it happen then? Why do some weak banks get a run and others don't?
This gets to a concept they talk about called sleepy depositors.
I love this term. It sounds like a bad indie band.
It's a perfect description, though. Most of us are sleepy. I mean, you don't check your bank's quarterly reports, do you?
No, I do not.
Because we're all sleepy. A bank can be fundamentally insolvent for a long time. It can be a zombie.
Walking dead.
Exactly. It just keeps operating even though its theta is way below the threshold. The run only happens when something wakes the sleepy depositors up.
Like a bad news story or the stock price collapses.
Right. But that's just the moment of realization. It's not the moment the bank actually went bad.
Which makes the run a lagging indicator, not a leading one.
Okay.
But they had an even stronger piece of evidence for this. They looked at what happened after the failure.
This is finding number three, recovery rates. And honestly, this is the smoking gun for their whole argument.
Okay, walk us through the logic here.
So if a bank is truly solvent, it has good assets, and it only fails because of a temporary panic, what should happen to the money owed to creditors?
Well, the loans are good, so eventually they should get paid back. Maybe not right away, but they should get everything back.
100 cents on the dollar, right. But in their historical sample, the average recovery rate for creditors was only 75%.
So a quarter of the money just vanished.
Vanished. And here's the real kicker. For the banks that specifically failed with a run, the recovery rate was even lower.
No way.
72%.
That is damning. Mm. If runs were killing healthy banks, that number should be near 100.
It absolutely should. The fact that it's so low is powerful evidence that the assets were bad to begin with. The banks were fundamentally insolvent.
And they backed this up by, well, actually reading the mail. They looked at the reports from the examiners who cleaned up the mess.
Finding number four, the expert assessments. Yeah, they analyzed over 2,000 postmortem reports from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC. These are the guys who went into the vaults after the doors closed.
And what did they blame for the failures?
Overwhelmingly, things like bad management, local economic depression, fraud, and just plain losses.
Did they blame the panics?
Out of more than 2,000 cases, the examiners cited runs or illiquidity as the primary cause in fewer than 20.
Fewer than 20. Out of 2,000, that's less than 1%.
Right. So the people who were actually there, on the ground, looking at the books in 1930, they didn't think it was a liquidity crisis. They knew it was a solvency crisis.
This just shifts the whole worldview. But I have to play devil's advocate for a second. We know panic is contagious. So if I'm running a perfectly healthy bank and everyone in town is panicking, why don't I fail?
That's the key question, isn't it? Why doesn't the contagion kill the strong? And the paper explains that healthy banks have survival mechanisms that weak banks just don't.
Like what?
Well, the most important one is the interbank market.
Bankers talking to other bankers.
Exactly. You, as a depositor, have no idea if your bank is safe. But other bankers, they usually have a pretty good idea. They see the flows, they know the reputations.
This is hypothesis 3 in the paper.
That's right. If a truly solvent bank faces a run, it can go to other banks and say, hey, look at my books. My theta is high. Lend me cash against these good assets.
And the other banks will do it.
Because it's a safe, profitable loan for them. So the interbank market acts as a filter. If you're healthy, you get a lifeline. If you're sick,
they let you drown. Because lending to you would be throwing good money after bad.
Precisely. The run kills you because you can't get liquidity, but you can't get liquidity because everyone knows you're insolvent.
There were other, more dramatic mechanisms, too. I love the visual of the truckload of cash.
Ah, signaling, yes. It sounds like something out of a movie, but it worked. A bank under pressure would literally have a massive shipment of gold or cash delivered through the front door.
Stack it up in the lobby.
Stack it up in the lobby.
Oh.
It sends a very clear signal to the depositors. We have the money. You don't need to panic.
But you can only pull that off if you actually have the assets to back it up.
An insolvent bank can't bluff with a truckload of cash it doesn't have.
And what about this suspension of convertibility? That sounds shady.
It was a gray area, for sure.
Mm.
But banks, usually coordinating through a local clearinghouse, would just stop paying out deposits.
It's a total timeout.
A total timeout. They'd close the doors for a week, maybe a month. But the goal wasn't to steal the money. It was to stop the fire sale and give examiners time to come in, audit the books, and publish the results.
And if the bank was solvent, the audit proved it, the panic subsided, and it reopened.
And if it was insolvent, it stayed closed. So all these tools, interbank loans, signaling, suspension, they all work to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Okay, so let's bring this into the 21st century, because we don't do suspensions anymore. We have the Fed and the FDIC.
And we had Silicon Valley Bank, SVB.
March 2023. That felt like a pure panic. I mean, watching it unfold on what was then Twitter, it was the fastest bank run in history.
$42 billion out the door in a single day. It was insane.
So does that break the model?
The paper argues,
yeah.
No. It argues SVB fits the historical pattern perfectly. It was a fundamental insolvency problem that was just masked by sleepy depositors.
But they had government bonds. I mean, those are the safest assets on earth.
Safe from default risk, yes, but not from interest rate risk. When the Fed hiked rates so fast, the market value of those bonds crashed. SVB had these massive unrealized losses on its books.
So if they were forced to sell those bonds at time one,
which the run forced them to do,
yeah,
they were insolvent. Their theta had dropped below the threshold.
So the Twitter run was just the sleepy depositors all waking up at the exact same moment.
All at once. It was a 19th century solvency crisis.
Yeah.
Just with a 21st century technology accelerant.
So what does this mean for policy? I mean, the usual playbook is lender of last resort. The Fed opens the liquidity fire hose.
And that's the whole point. If you believe the old liquidity view that panic kills healthy banks, then the lender of last resort is the perfect tool. You just need to spray cash everywhere and calm everyone down.
But if you believe this paper's solvency view,
then just providing liquidity is dangerous. It's like bailing out a bucket that has a hole in it. You're just propping up zombie banks and putting taxpayer money at risk.
So what should regulators do instead?
The authors argue for solvency support, which means stricter capital requirements, forcing banks to hold more equity, more of their own skin in the game, so they can absorb losses without collapsing.
And better supervision, I assume?
Much better. The paper points out that deposit insurance has led to this world of supervisory closure.
Meaning banks don't fail because of lines at the door.
Right. They fail because a regulator walks in on a Friday afternoon and shuts them down, which means the regulator has to be the one to spot the rot, because the depositors, we aren't looking anymore.
Deposit insurance is a powerful sleeping pill.
For market discipline, absolutely.
So this leads to a final, pretty provocative thought to leave with everyone. We're in a new era. Digital wallets, instant transfers, social media.
Like the era of the wakeful depositor.
Exactly. The friction is gone. You don't have to take a day off work to go stand in line. You can start a bank run from your couch.
So the question is, does that make the system more fragile or more robust?
My gut reaction is fragile. Faster runs have to mean faster collapses.
That's one view, for sure. But consider the alternative the authors hint at. If bankers now know that depositors are no longer sleepy, if they know that any sign of weakness, any bad quarterly report could trigger an instant catastrophic run, maybe that forces them to be better.
Fear as a disciplining force.
Yes. If that sleepy depositor buffer is gone, maybe banks can't afford to become zombies in the first place. They have to keep their fundamentals absolutely pristine, or they die immediately.